everybody, and welcome to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe. I'm your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we have Dr. Eric Gardner. He teaches at Saginaw Valley State University in the English department, as it happens. Eric is a distinguished scholar of 19th century African-American literature. He received his B.A. at Illinois Wesleyan University and his Ph.D. at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. Today we'll be talking to him about his book, Jenny Carter, A Black Journalist of the Early West. I really enjoyed reading the book, and I admire the book very much because Eric did something that any historian should admire, and that is he discovered something that really wasn't known, and that is both the literary contributions of Jenny Carter and her identity. So as I said, I really enjoyed talking to Eric, and I hope you enjoy listening to us. Here's the interview. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing all right. I got a little bit of a cold, but I'll try not to be too squeaky for you.
Oh, do you really? So. I'm really sorry about that. Today we have Eric Gardner with us, and he has edited a new book on Jenny Carter with the subtitle A Black Journalist in the Early West. It's a fascinating book. I've had a chance to read it, and my research assistants and I had a really excellent discussion about it yesterday, so I'm really looking forward to talking about the book. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about Eric. Eric, why don't you fill us in a little bit on your background, where you grew up, where you went to school, and so on and so forth.
Well, I'm an Illinoisan by birth, and I think I was one of always those geeky kids that loved story in all its forms, and so that took certainly the form of reading voraciously all the way through, but it also took a form of listening to stories that family members told, and mm-hmm. I think also a really early deep interest in genealogy, which I know lots of academics sort of consider that a weird stepchild of history.
I don't know. I was going to say, I just a little bit of a plug here. I back in the late 90s when the internet broke, I taught a genealogy class at Harvard because they wouldn't let me teach it in the history department. So I had to teach it in the extension school.
Oh, indeed.
It was one of my most popular classes. People loved it.
Well, because it allows you to really think about people that are connected to you directly.
Absolutely.
As being participants in, you know, a broader world.
Absolutely.
And I think that sense of finding out people's stories and thinking about how stories work to convey information and to preserve memory and to construct memory shaped a lot of my work all the way through. I did my undergraduate at Illinois Wesleyan, which is a small liberal arts school in Illinois, and couldn't decide, and so ended up taking a major in English, but then doing two minors, which was sort of unheard of there, a minor in history and a minor in American studies, because blissfully they were willing to, you know, let me indulge all of those passions and put them together.
That's what liberal arts colleges are for.
I'm major proponent of that.
I went to one too. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, and. From there, I went to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and did my master's and doctorate degrees both there.
Oh, really? Okay.
And again, had the wonderful chance to not only fall in with a group of literary scholars who were deeply, deeply interested in thinking about literature as not only happening in a historical moment, but as being an agent for historical change. Nina Boehm was my dissertation director, and mm-hmm. she's a general editor of the Norton Anthologies of American Literature, and has done a great deal of recovery work on women writers of the 19th century.
And so
we worked together fairly closely. The other nice thing about Illinois was that it was very much... if you know the 19th century writer Ralph Waldo Emerson's discussion of what a university should be, he talks about bringing these luminaries from everywhere, and that the university is this place of concentrated fire. And so Illinois was a place where I could go and listen to lectures in the history department from scholars like Vernon Burton, but also I could go to the library school and talk with bibliographers and book historians like Donald Crummell and art historians, and think about how all of those things were working together, even as I was, you know, focusing very much on literature. And I think I sort of came to African-American studies specifically through some of that work, I knew that I wanted to work in a field of literature that would where those you know, those interests and where those abilities would help further knowledge. And it didn't seem like for me that writing the 500th interpretation of Moby Dick would be the you know, the contribution that I could make. But you know, with a lot of the women writers that that Nina was working with, and then especially it turned out with a lot of the African American writers, you know, we weren't suddenly we weren't talking about what Herman Melville had for breakfast on the morning that he wrote chapter 50. You know, we were talking about well, when was this person born? You know, what was their parentage?
Right.
You know, really basic
right.
information. I did some early work, and it actually ended up being my first published piece, a piece for the New England Quarterly that looked at Harriet Wilson's 1859 book *Our Nig*, and tracked down extant copies. Looked at them for marginal notations and especially ownership markings, records of provenance, trying to trace who the original book buyers were to get a sense of where that book might have ended up, what the audience might have been. And that, you know, again, sort of weaving together of certainly historical works, some genealogical work, and also thinking about literary text in terms of author and audience and intent and those kinds of questions.
Uh-huh.
And from there, you know, that I think really sort of kicked into gear the sense that, well, you know, it really was a viable possibility, and it really would make a useful contribution to the dialogue to think about, you know, going out and finding more, you know, looking for more information on authors, trying to find out some of the things that we were missing, and really in lots of ways, Jenny Carter is about getting a body of texts that maybe 10 of us had read out to, you know, a much broader range of people.
Well, I think you make a very good point about the tension in all of the humanities and perhaps the social sciences, if history is a social science, I don't know, between the pull of the established and wanting to interpret it and the kind of urge to find the new. And I know that historians feel this all the time, because on the one hand, we read about the same people. I guess in the case of, to use a 19th century American analogy, it's always another book about Lincoln. We know so much about Lincoln. We know more about Lincoln than Lincoln knew about Lincoln.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
There are so many books published on Lincoln every year that it boggles the mind. None of them really uncover anything new. They just reinterpret something that was discovered probably in the late 19th or early 20th century about Lincoln.
Sure.
No new caches of letters, so on and so forth. But then on the other hand, you know, there are all these books, and they tend to be not widely read because they don't have a lot of name recognition. That is, the people about which they write don't have a lot of name recognition. You know, I think people don't understand the contribution that is made when you uncover somebody who at the moment might not seem to be very important, but in fact was at the time in which they were writing or acting. And I think that's the case with Jenny Carter. That's why I found it so impressive, is that, you know, unlike many people in English, you have uncovered something that was heretofore unknown. And that's a huge contribution, and you should be congratulated for it. I mean, it is so often the case that you're absolutely right. It's a funny analogy, you know, that you do try to figure out what Melville was having for breakfast before he wrote the fourth chapter of Moby Dick. Not that anybody really reads Moby Dick very often anyway, but yeah.
Oh, no, actually, it's wonderful.
No, I'm sure it is. You should talk to
my wife. I still don't think that. I have a running joke with one of my colleagues. We'll start off emails with, you know, scrambled eggs and toast, because,
yeah, right.
You know, that must be what Melville had for breakfast that day.
Right.
But, you know, and I certainly think that there's, you know, gosh, a lot more out there than we might be led to believe.
Oh, no,
and
I'm sure of that, yeah.
You know, this is certainly true, I think, in 19th century African-American literary study, because of the structure of, you know, the academic institution as a social structure, you know, just kicked those texts out for ages.
Yeah.
And you know, libraries didn't collect them. And, of course, with somebody like Carter, we're talking about publications mainly in the black press.
Right? Yeah.
What do you do with a newspaper when you're done with it? You know, so,
but it's funny.
So,
you mentioned the library school at Champaign-Urbana, and that's a very famous one, obviously. But I was going to say, you know, if you just look through, and I've done this before and been kind of amazed, if you just look through the they don't have the card catalog anymore, but when they had it, if you just file through the card catalog of one of these great, you know, libraries that was started in the 19th century, great university libraries, one of these big land-grant universities, you find things in your field that you never heard of.
That's right.
Nobody has looked at for 100 years. And each one of them could be a gold mine. You just don't know. But some careful bibliographer in the 19th century said, this is worth having. And we're going to get, you know, it's a print run of 200, and we're going to get one of the copies. All the other ones are gone, and there it is. But because we're so busy with Melville, nobody ever pays any attention to those things. And it is, you know, and it is kind of difficult, you know, if your object is to get an academic job, which is no easy trick, then studying very obscure people probably isn't the best way to go. So that's an additional part of the tension that we were talking about before. So
absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's a difficult thing to negotiate, whether you should go and find out something new, mine some archive that's never been looked at before, work on an author who's incredibly obscure by our lights, or go for the, you know, Foucault on Melville or what it would be. You know, I mean, there's a lot of that going around. At least there was when I was in graduate school. Foucault on Lincoln.
You know, and when I did, you know, way back when I did the dissertation, it was centered around Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yep.
And you know, brought in Frederick Douglass, and so here you've got probably the most important white abolitionist novelist, Stowe.
Yep.
You know, writing Uncle Tom's Cabin and writing then a variety of other texts that are anti-slavery, and you've got Frederick Douglass, probably the most prominent black abolitionist of the period, and certainly one of the most important to African American letters. And so, you know, I wanted to shoot for those, you know, those major figures in the dissertation, and it was fun, and it was you know, I think worthwhile for me to learn through, but in the end, that was not the kind of contribution that I thought that I should be making.
Right. I mean, in the publishing trade, we call that a good commercial hook.
Yeah. And you know, somewhere along the line, I think it must have worked in some regard. I was lucky enough to get a tenure track job, and you know, to have that at a place that I've really grown to love in lots of ways.
Terrific.
But it was, you know, it's a teaching center job, and so the heavy teaching load, and now a fair amount of administrative responsibilities. I threw myself into those things with a passion, and just sort of assumed that you know, I'd continue this digging on the on the side, and just sort of for fun. And then, oh gosh, probably about 6 years ago, a couple of things happened. One was that you know, as posts would come up on listservs, or as I would be in conversation with folks at conferences, a topic would come up, and I would say, oh, you know, I got a couple of things in my files about that. Let me send you some of my notes, and you could, you know, you can use them. And some of those folks would come back and say, you know, you ought to get this out, you ought to share this more formally. Second thing that happened, you know, totally unrelated to the Academy, but also deeply related to the Academy. Our twin girls were born. And when you have any baby, but especially two, you suddenly become a lot more efficient.
Yeah.
And you got a lot less sleep. Between those two things, and also there has been within African American studies over the past decade a real concentrated attention to going back into all sorts of archives and thinking about establishing some of those kinds of sources that have been around for years in other fields, but that are lacking. And so, probably one of the most exciting events, I think, easily in the decade, maybe in the century, is the publication of the African American National Biography, because, you know, suddenly we have thousands of biographical entries on folks that aren't mentioned anyplace else at all.
No, those are absolutely terrific resources, and the people that put them together are kind of unsung heroes. I mean, they go along with reference librarians in my book, as, you know, they really do the fundamental research in the humanities. These are the people that put it together. And then everything that we do is built on what they do. I completely agree with that, that these are remarkable resources, and they really are the bedrocks of humanities scholarship. Without these things, we could not work. So kudos to those people.
Yeah. And I mean, because it does allow then so much other work to take place.
Yeah, no, right.
Because suddenly you don't have, I don't know if you've followed the the drama. It's been a little more than a year ago about Emma Dunham Kelly Hawkins, who was widely known as especially within literary study as being one of the earliest African American women novelists. She published a couple of novels in the 1890s,
mm-hmm.
And in fact, before some recent discoveries, there were some that actually argued that she was the first woman African-American novelist, because her novel, her first novel came out in 1891, which is the year before Iola Leroy, Frances Harper's novel that came out in 92.
Mm-hmm.
And even after she was displaced, it was recognized that she was a key early black woman novelist, and her work was always really difficult for folks to think about, because there were no black characters, no black subjects at all.
Mm-hmm.
These were very white, in quote, stories.
Fascinating.
There was also no real biographical material on her, and folks had been stumped for ages. She had been listed in just about all of the prominent bibliographies starting in the 1950s of African American lit, and her books were included. Oxford did a 40-volume set of black women's 19th-century writing in
mm-hmm.
in the late 80s, and they were included there.
Mm-hmm.
And we come to find out through the work of a couple of scholars, including a very skilled genealogist, that Emma Dunham Kelly Hawkins is not black. She's white.
Yeah.
Her inclusion in this bibliography in the 1950s is erroneous, and it's one of those sort of crucial errors that starts off, that cascades and leads to everybody making those kinds of assumptions.
What a remarkable story.
So what do you do now that, I've based my reading of 19th century African American literature on this pair of texts by a woman who, never even claimed that race. And certainly, for six generations of her family wasn't of that race.
I don't mean to digress, but could you explain to me especially, but also our listeners, exactly how this mistake came to be made if she never claimed to be black?
I wish I could tell you for certain.
Okay, go ahead, guess.
I can't explain the original mistake.
Uh-huh.
But because the bibliographer who includes the work, Evelyn Whiteman, who does some bibliographies of African American literature in the 1950s, is actually very good, and is one of those wonderful archivists who saved things that otherwise would have been thrown out.
Yeah.
And so some of the base bibliographic scholarship that folks work from, we wouldn't be able to do things had he not done that. But for some baffling reason, he included Emma Dunham Kelly Hawkins' books there.
Huh.
And so that bibliography then is cited by just about everybody subsequent to that.
Right.
And then the other sort of interesting wrinkle is that one of the books has a frontispiece portrait of Kelly Hawkins. And it's one of those, black and white photographs of the 1890s where the lighting and tinting is always kind of funny.
Uh-huh.
And she looks a little dark.
Uh-huh.
And so folks began then to read that visual image as, oh, okay, she's a light-skinned black woman.
That is amazing.
And of course, she's in Whiteman's bibliography, and she's in all of these other bibliographies. So that must be the way that we have to read the photograph. And so between those two pieces, I think folks then, just sort of built on those assumptions. How essential it is to have that base scholarship.
That's amazing.
Before we do the other stuff.
I confess I wear my ignorance on my sleeve, so I had not heard about this at all. Has this been covered in the press in any way? Has anyone written a popular article about this?
It has a bit there. It was in the Boston Globe. It made it to NPR and a couple of places like that. But
yeah.
There are still, for example, websites that my students, will bring in that,
sure.
That still list her as, here's this African American author.
Right.
Well, so
that's amazing.
Amazing story.
No,
yeah.
I see just what you mean. No, I actually wrote early in my career a bibliography, a book-length bibliography of incredibly obscure accounts of Russia in the 16th
mm-hmm.
and 17th century, and I can tell you with great assurance that it is full of errors.
Yeah.
This is a warning to anybody that uses it.
Well, I know. We're all imperfect, I think. Yeah.
It's full of mistakes.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't know. I mean, because I was relying on other people. It kind of indicates the amount of trust that you have to put in your sources, because I was just trusting these sources and saying, well, if it was written by this person, then it's probably correct, so I'll put it in my bibliography, and I simply copy it.
And you can see how errors get passed on in that way, mm-hmm. through that device mm-hmm. of trust. Yeah, that's quite a remarkable story. Well, anyway,
go ahead.
No, you
I was going to say, I also think that I think it talks a little bit about, you know, maybe about how we talk about scholarship, because, you know, I tell that story to my students, and their immediate response is, you know, gasp, did you write something assuming that she was, you know, African-American? Did, you know, what happens to a critic that
right.
made that assumption?
Right.
You know, their first response is, you know, oh, I'd be so embarrassed. I'd be, you know, so ashamed.
Right.
I think the neat thing that they then begin to recognize is that working on mistakes, moving knowledge forward, is what scholarship ought to be doing.
Right.
And so we don't want to take, you know, we don't want to take any of those kinds of things as gospel. We want to, you know, trace them back and examine them closely, recognizing that they're a step in this ongoing dialogue. I think if we learn anything from, you know, that fascinating story of Emma Dunn and Kelly Hawkins, it's that, you know, don't assume, you know, build from the dialogue and recognize that you're going to make those mistakes along the line and that helps the scholarly dialogue, hopefully.
So, I'm reminded of the words of Ronald Reagan, who was not a great literary scholar or historian, but did come up with a very pithy phrase in this regard, trust but verify. That's what he was all about, trust but verify.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, Ronald Reagan, yes, great man there. Well,
indeed.
Let's turn to Jenny Carter then. Can you set the scene a little bit for Jenny Carter? In other words, well, I guess what I'd like you to do first of all is, how did you encounter Jenny Carter? Where did you first find her? Yeah.
Yeah, the first thing to say is that I didn't encounter Jenny Carter. I read some columns by a pen named Semper Fidelis in The Elevator, which is a newspaper that was published in black newspaper in San Francisco that was published beginning right after the Civil War and running into the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always sort of been, you know, interested in the columns of Semper Fidelis because they're lively and engaging and they've got a little bit of sass to them, and they certainly speak directly to covering African Americans in a really unexpected place, San Francisco, in the Reconstruction. And there are a couple of other folks who had read the columns and used them in other sources. Mitch Cashoon, in his really fine book on Black Emancipation Celebrations, quotes a couple of Semper Fidelis's columns.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, just a minute.
No problem.
I think I sort of just left it at that because tracking down a pen name, especially in 19th century, is oftentimes fraught with all sorts of difficulties.
Yeah, that's tough work.
And and on another project, totally unrelated, I was going through the Christian Recorder, which is the newspaper of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. It's published out of Philadelphia, and it began fairly contemporary with The Elevator, although it's actually still published today. And so I was going through issues of the Christian Recorder from the late 1860s and early 1870s on a different project, and just doing a page-by-page reading,
mm-hmm.
and saw a column signed by Semper Fidelis that stylistically was very, very consonant with the kinds of things that I remembered reading in The Elevator, and sort of filed it away and said, if I ever find anything more on Semper Fidelis in addition to The Elevator stuff that we know about, there's a piece in the Recorder.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go back and look at that. Then as I was paging through continuing to go through the issues, the Recorder would regularly advertise its next volume year because they wanted to try and convince folks to file annual subscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would list the authors that were going to contribute. And they, in that sort of long listing, they promised more work by Semper Fidelis.
Oh.
And then below it said Mrs. D.D. Carter, Nevada City, California. And so I fell out of my chair just about, then the question became, okay, so who's Mrs. D.D. Carter? Is she the same Semper Fidelis writing for the Recorder as is writing for the Elevator? Can we go beyond the stylistic similarities and, get some hardcore verifiable biographical information from enough different kinds of sources so that we know? So that, that set off that the large scale digging for finding the identity of Mrs. D.D. Carter, making sure that she was indeed the contributor not only to the Recorder but also to the Elevator, and then trying to find more about her. But I think in some ways it's really sort of it's a fitting testament to her work that reading her columns when I didn't have a clue of who she was, those columns still stuck in my head.
Huh.
And you know, the name was there. And so it was, you know, a sort of combination of just incredibly dumb luck, good dumb luck, but also that you know, her work had been, had made a strong enough impression on me, mm-hmm. to sit in my mind and allow me to to make that kind of connection.
That's absolutely terrific story. I mean, that kind of discovery really makes the kind of hairs on the back of my neck stand up, because I've had a couple of moments like that in my own research career, but just a couple. But when they happen and you see it, you do just about fall out of your chair. You just can't believe your good luck, because that's really what it is. I mean, for all that we work very hard, and we do work very hard, those moments are few and far between and largely a result of chance. But when they happen, they really make it all worthwhile, to use a kind of shop-worn cliche. So then tell us about Jenny Carter. What were you able to find out about her? Can you give us her biography? Or as much of it as possible?
I give you a piece.
Okay.
But again, it's, you know, so emblematic of 19th century African-American literary study that there are some big gaps there. As far as we can tell, she's born in about 1830, give or take a year. I don't know a birthplace yet. Possibilities include everything from New York State to New Orleans. And the first 30-plus years of her life are really still very much a significant mystery. She talks a little bit about them in her columns. She talks about being in a range of different places, New York, New Orleans, some time in Illinois, some time in Kentucky.
And you were able to find her. You were able to find her in censuses in both New York and in probably somebody by that name.
No, nothing.
Oh, really? Okay.
Nothing good yet.
Okay.
She and so, you know, again, the sense that before I wanted to make those assertions, I wanted to be able to verify them in a range of different sources, not just, you know, not just
sure.
her columns, because, you know, she's writing under a pen name, and occasionally she will create a persona that surrounds that pen name. And in addition to Semper Fidelis, she wrote under Mrs. Joan Trask, Anne J. Trask, Mrs. Trask, a variety of different, and sometimes those pen names become sort of characters, and so you want to make sure that she's not just telling a fictional story or a slightly fictional story.
Sure.
And so she talks about, you know, being in those places, and she also talks about being a school teacher, talks about her reading and a little bit about her early education, not too specific, but not a great deal. She doesn't come into focus until late 1866, when she marries Dennis Drummond Carter. Drummond Carter is a fascinating guy in his own right. He grew up in free African American in Philadelphia, although his mother and he had immigrated from the South when he was a child, and he became quite a noted musician, and he toured with Frank Johnson's band. Frank Johnson was this wonderful African American band leader in Philadelphia in the 1830s. Nationally known and quite remarkable, but Dennis Carter, like more than 1,000 of his fellows, free African Americans in the North, did what lots of other folks in the States did in the late 40s and early 50s when gold is discovered in California.
Mm-hmm.
They think, oh, well, maybe. And so Carter goes west and works as a miner for a while. By the time he marries Jenny Carter, he's back to working as a musician and teaching music, because, of course, the service industries and communities grow once there are a critical mass of people in California.
Yeah.
They marry in late 1866, and it's only a year after that a woman calling herself Anne J. Trask sends a letter to the San Francisco Elevator, and, you know, explains to the editor, Philip Bell, who's another fascinating story, explains to Bell that you know, now that the paper is circulating among African Americans in the, you know, in the state, that there should be some regular feature for children, and she suggests that she would send him a weekly piece of short fiction or prose, or you know, maybe even poems that were specifically designed for children, and begins. And her initial, first couple pieces in early 1867 are very much stories that are designed for children, and she writes one about mistakes, actually titled "Mistakes," And at the end of it, she sort of steps back and says, oh, well, you know, I see that I've made a mistake myself. It's another of the uncountable ones. I started off writing for children, and I've ended up writing for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the sort of moment where she begins to broaden the focus of her columns. And so over the next 7 years or so, and I say that because 1874 is a moment when the elevator, the extant copies of the elevator just aren't there.
Mm.
I know she was writing after 1874, but I haven't been able to find any of those pieces.
Mm.
But up to 1874, between 67 and 74, she writes over 70 pieces.
Mm-hmm.
For this black newspaper in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and they range incredibly widely in terms of topics. There are, you know, certainly some more stories for children and you know, things that are didactic, designed to give a moral lesson, but there is also commentary on California politics, on the ways in which Reconstruction is taking shape, on black male suffrage, on the possibility of women's suffrage. She writes about temperance.
Mm-hmm.
She writes about higher education, you know, just a full range
mm-hmm.
of issues. And in this period, the late 60s, is when she sends one of her pieces to the Christian Recorder,
mm-hmm.
And then they unmask her. And mm-hmm. She only publishes one of the pieces in the Recorder. And I my gut is that they had that piece before they ran her name and that she chose not to send them anything else.
Yeah, I see.
You know, after that, the secret is sort of out. And so in the early 1870s, and especially 73 and 74, you'll see the elevator occasionally refer to Semper Fidelis as Mrs. D.D. Carter.
Uh-huh.
And so the elevator is then at that point sort of willing to admit her identity. But the set of fascinating things are that the first is that she's actually not living in San Francisco all of this time. Dennis Carter settles in a small town named Nevada City,
mm-hmm.
which is now maybe 45 minutes drive from Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a relatively small black community, but it has ties to the larger communities in Sacramento and especially San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And so through Carter, we're not only getting a sense of black California, but we're getting this, again, a voice that we really don't often hear, this small town in California, relatively mm-hmm. small black community. And it also becomes clear that folks in the town and in the area eventually know who she is,
mm-hmm.
because, of course, the elevator is not just a San Francisco paper for African Americans. It really becomes and tries to be an African American paper for the West, and
mm-hmm.
so it has correspondents in British Columbia, it has correspondents in Idaho, correspondents in New Mexico, correspondents mm-hmm. in Nevada, you know, really a wide range of black news in the West. And those folks then are all reading Jenny Carter, and she's reading the kinds of things that are going on there.
Yeah, I think it's important to say. Sorry to interrupt. I think it's important to say.
Oh, that's okay.
If I understand correctly, that this elevator is not a device that is designed to take people up to the top of tall buildings. This means to elevate the race, as I'm.
It does, but I think it. I think even there, you have to suggest that race has two meanings. Certainly, it talks about elevating the African American race.
Yeah.
The paper very much focuses on that specific community.
Uh-huh.
But again and again, Bell or Carter or some of the other writers will remind folks that we're also talking about elevating the human race.
I see. Okay.
That white folks ought to be reading this and
right.
ought to be recognizing the things that we're doing right and do them too. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's also, I think, a play on the current technology, because that's something that is just coming to the public notice.
Yep.
Otis's elevator, made its splash, and the first elevator is installed in San Francisco about at that time.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, that's interesting. I was going to say, could you tell us a little bit about the black press in general? Because I think one of the things that people have forgotten, and I know that I don't really have a very great awareness of it, is that, in fact, at this time and for many decades thereafter, there was an entire black press establishment, and every major city had a black paper, or many black papers in some cases.
Yeah, sometimes more. Yeah. The antebellum period, we see a number of startup efforts that last for a year, 2 years, really beginning with Freedom's Journal, which is a New York City paper published in 1827 and 1828. There are sort of sporadic black papers in the pre-Civil War period, but oftentimes they are fraught with economic difficulties, but also they have trouble getting readership because there are better funded white papers
right.
that have the abolitionist viewpoint and do cover the black, you know, black communities, like Garrison's William Lloyd Garrison's Boston paper, The Liberator,
yeah, the Liberator
which is
yeah.
really a national paper,
mm-hmm.
But after the Civil War, things changed significantly because in addition to the sense that the black polity may be actually invested with some rights of citizenship, you also have a number of entities thinking about, okay, well, what do we do with this massive new freed population? Because we have to think about getting them basic literacy skills, but we also have to think about getting them a public voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see papers like the African Methodist Episcopal Church's Christian Recorder really become not just a church organ, but a national paper trying to, you know, spread church values.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see Recorder writers among the teachers that go out and teach for the Freedmen's Bureau, which
uh-huh.
is a, you know, sort of massive government effort to, you know, to think about what to do with the newly freed folks. And you see the Recorder being used as a literacy text, right? Let's learn
mm-hmm.
to read, and we'll learn to read using the Recorder. You also see lots of black papers spring up across the Reconstruction South as African Americans gain that sort of you know, public presence and become involved in legislative affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in some of the larger urban communities in the North, you see again the sense of you know, a community coalescing and needing that kind of voice. And so there are a large number of papers in the second half of the 19th century that are black-owned,
mm-hmm.
black-run, largely written by black folks, and largely designed to be read specifically by black folks. And
yep.
The Elevator, you know, sits in that group. It's actually connected to another black paper in San Francisco, The Pacific Appeal, for a little while, and then separates off. But the root of those was a statewide convention of African American leaders that said, we need a newspaper.
Huh.
We need some way to cover the community and to share news and to,
yeah.
you know, publicly debate questions.
Yeah.
And in that, the Elevator's a lot like, you know, much later papers like the Indianapolis Freeman or
mm-hmm.
like the Chicago Defender in the 20th century. But it's a real rich range of discussion of the community by the community. And it's also something, unfortunately, that until very recently has been widely ignored.
Yeah, I think it has, actually.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I was listening to a story about coverage of the Iraq War. And they interviewed a guy who writes for, and I don't know what the name of the paper is, but he writes for a black paper in Philadelphia. And I thought to myself, a black paper in Philadelphia? There are still black papers? Who knew about
yeah.
this? You know,
yeah.
I mean, I knew,
yeah.
I kind
yeah.
of vaguely knew that there used to be them, but I just somehow forgotten it. But this was kind of a huge establishment at the time. I mean, there was
yes.
every reasonably sized black community had one, or as I say, more. So how big was the African-American community in San Francisco at the time?
It's a little tough to say because racial classification gets a little sticky, especially when light-skinned folks go to a place thousands of miles from where anybody knows them.
Sure.
In terms of, you know, we're never talking above the low thousands,
mm-hmm.
1 or 2,000.
Yeah.
And the Elevator circulation, in terms of paid subscribers, never passes 800.
Uh-huh.
But again, that in some ways is you know, much more significant than you would expect because when you have one person with a newspaper, how many people share that newspaper?
Yeah,
how
sure.
many people does she read it to?
Sure.
You know, those kinds of things. So the sense is, and the funny thing, I guess one of the funny things, something that I didn't know, is that I had always followed the sort of set assumption that you can see in a great deal of the history that's been written is this emphasis on free African Americans clustering around urban centers
mm-hmm.
In the North, and that's not really the case. Actually, anywhere, but it's not the case in California. There are, you know, lots of these small little communities, like the one in Nevada City,
yeah.
Like one in the neighboring Grass Valley, and so they view this San Francisco community, which, you know, if you say it's 1,000 people, that still sounds fairly small, but that becomes this sort of hub of all of these African Americans and smaller communities, you know, around the region.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have deep connections with communities in Los Angeles and San Jose, you know, connections with communities in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing thing about the black press that, again, I don't think lots of folks know about or have really studied is that they're participating in that 19th century trend of regular 19th century practice of newspaper exchange. And so they'll send free copies of The Elevator out to any newspaper that will send them back. And Bell, who's this who's a long-established journalist within the black community, understands this process and so is sending out The Elevator to the Christian Recorder and the Cincinnati Colored Citizen and getting then copies of these papers back. They're publishing excerpts, and so you can read the Christian Recorder and see little items that have been clipped out of The Elevator and vice versa. But also then those newspapers are sitting around Bell's office, and his writers are reading them. And so there really becomes the sense that the black press might be a vehicle for fostering a broader national dialogue between African Americans who are really scattered all over the nation.
I see. Could you tell us a little bit more about Philip Bell then, who hired Jenny Carter eventually? I don't know if hired is the right verb for that, but took her work. Was she ever paid for any of this?
I don't think so, because Bell was always running on a shoestring.
Yeah, I imagine.
Sometimes had trouble making rent.
Yeah, no, I was.
The newspaper then did so.
A newspaper editor once told me that the best way to run a newspaper is not pay the writers.
That's right.
The surest road.
Followed by not paying the rent.
To profitability. Yeah. Don't pay the writers.
That's right. Yeah.
So tell us a little about Philip Bell.
Well, Bell actually is a New Yorker by birth and becomes, and he's a free African-American, becomes active in the black press incredibly early. He works with a paper published out of New York City called The Colored American in the 1830s, which is really, in that sort of pre-Bellum period where there just aren't a lot of black newspapers, and so The Colored American really is a landmark in lots of different ways. And at that point, he's networking with a number of leaders in the broader African American community. So he's networking with Charles Ray, who's active in a variety of different venues. He knows Frederick Douglass. He knows William Wells Brown, a range of these folks. And even after the Colored American folds, he continues to write for some of the other sort of freestanding black papers. He writes occasionally for The White Liberator, but he also publishes things in The Christian Recorder and in Frederick Douglass's various newspapers. And he runs an information office. That's actually what they call it in New York City. And the information office is a sort of combination news service, job placement service. So folks who wanted 10 waiters for a party would call Bell, and he would go out into the community and recruit 10 good waiters. But also it sounds like because he was so then connected with so much of the community that those information offices became sites of black resistance, aiding fugitive slaves, doing a range of different kinds of things. And he's sort of recruited to go west and help with the Pacific Appeal when it's being built in the middle of the Civil War. And he works with the Appeal for a while, has a major falling out with the editor there, and in 1865 starts up his own venture, The Elevator. And for the next 2.5 decades, Philip Bell really is The Elevator. He makes sure that funds come in. He harasses leaders of the community, or encourages them, or entices them, all sorts of things to make sure that he can get money to get this out there. And he sets up a network of subscription agents across the Black West, even in the sort of so far west that it's far east, because he has connections with black expatriate communities in Japan and China, and so he's got a subscription agent in Japan for a while. But he's all about getting The Elevator out there, and really becomes in some significant ways an institution. When he dies, one of the San Francisco white papers talks about that this is a guy. And first, I think it's notable that he's eulogized in the white press at the time, and not ignored, as so many of the African American leaders were consciously ignored. Let's leave him out.
Yeah.
San Francisco white paper writes about him as being this man who would be walking along the street in a very dignified manner, but if he began talking with you, or if you began talking with him, he would argue with you about anything and never let you win.
That sounds like a lot of editors I know.
So, yeah. And so Bell really sees himself as being, you know, this that we've got to get the paper out, because the paper is the community. It is
yep.
the multiple voices of the community.
Uh-huh.
And so he and Carter actually have a pretty fascinating relationship. It's clear that they become friends over the years. And it's possible that Bell actually knew Dennis Drummond Carter before Jenny Carter started sending him stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also pretty definite on his sense of what gender should look like,
mm-hmm.
What women should do and should not do. Then, ironically, he becomes an advocate for women's suffrage.
Mm-hmm.
And Jenny Carter is actually opposed
is that
to
right?
women's suffrage. She is, because and most of it comes from there's a fairly significant schism that happens when there's a move to enfranchise African-American men, because, of course, a number of white women suffragettes who have suffragist activists have been, active in the abolitionist movement
yep.
all the way through, and say, well, you know, why not us too?
Right.
And then, in addition to that very valid claim, some of those folks, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, hook up with a guy named George Francis Train, who is an incredible racist.
Yeah.
And so some of the arguments over, that they advanced during the late 60s are, why do you want to give a vote to these people when you're not, giving them to, smart white women?
Right.
And so there's a real rift. And Carter identifies with... She identifies racially at that moment, and so she argues for African American men getting the vote,
mm-hmm.
And then that we'll deal with Frances Harper, another black activist, woman activist of the time, says that she'll set the lesser question of sex aside
mm-hmm.
for the time, and so Carter comes out and says no to women's suffrage because she is so vehemently arguing for black male suffrage
uh-huh.
first.
Yeah.
But Bell disagrees with her, and so they back and forth on that in pretty lively ways.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that too is emblematic of the black press of the period. It's not univocal. There's lots of mm-hmm. rich arguments, and you really mm-hmm. get to see people trying to figure out complex issues and disagreeing with each other and bringing in personal stuff too. Even though it's really clear that he and Carter disagree on a couple of these key issues,
mm-hmm.
she continues to send stuff to him. He continues to publish it.
Mm-hmm. And was the normal modus operandi for her simply to send things over the transom and for him to publish them? He didn't make assignments to her, did he? Or do we know about that?
We don't know about it definitively. Given the character and the voice in most of the pieces, I would hazard a guess that most of them come from her.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, when she travels, there's an extended trip that she takes to San Francisco early in her writing career, and then also late in her writing career, she takes an extended trip to Carson City and
uh-huh.
The city surrounding there. And at those moments, it's very, very clear that Bell has consciously said, I want you to write about what you think of the black community here. I want you to report back.
Uh-huh.
I want you to see what's going on. So there was that kind of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the pieces, and I think it's also probably important to point out that the newspapers of the period in general, and black newspapers especially, aren't the kind of... slick industrial things that we see now, and so you see stories and poems and personal essays and a real wide range of genres and topics
uh-huh.
In these. And so, we sort of struggled over the title of the book. Is Jenny Carter a black journalist? Well, she does do some things that we would think of in contemporary terms as a journalist. That is, she goes to events and she reports on them.
Mm-hmm.
But she's also a political commentator, a moral commentator,
mm-hmm.
A good storyteller. Some of the pieces are fiction. She writes occasionally, sends in a poem for her weekly contribution.
Mm-hmm.
So a real wide range of different kinds of texts. And a lot of those texts that fall outside of the realm of reporting on events, it's pretty clear those are the things that she's thinking about and the
mm-hmm.
things that she wants to share or wants mm-hmm. to talk about. And so those are very much, self-texts that are motivated by something, that's in herself.
Why do you think that Jenny Carter wrote I know that's a tough question. It's not really answerable, but go ahead.
Well, and, you know, this is always right. The biographer's struggle is right, getting in somebody's head and wondering, you know, what was the motivation, especially when there's so much information about her that we don't know.
Yep.
You know, I wish I knew her favorite color, for example. little bits like that.
Yeah.
I think part of the answer has to be seen in her choice of pseudonyms, because when she chooses Semper Fidelis, this is before John Philip Sousa and before the Marines, and before that term has the kind of resonance that it might in today's popular culture, right? When 19th century readers see Semper Fidelis, they don't immediately think Marine Semper Fi. They probably are thinking the Latin root, which is always faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And her idea then is that it is a gesture of faith in the community, for the community, to get that voice out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's, you know, writing to report things that might not otherwise be reported.
Mm-hmm.
She's writing about topics that she thinks need to be discussed but might not otherwise mm-hmm. be discussed. So she writes, for example, one of her early pieces for children is actually about color prejudice within the African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very clear mm-hmm. that she recognizes that this isn't something that we talk about in public spheres often, but boy, we need to, right? And so the sense is that by getting her voice out there, she is being always faithful.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very much that sort of communitarian ethos that she's mm-hmm. hoping that if she gets this stuff out there, that it will make some kind of change happen, that people will hear it and say, oh, you know, and maybe agree and maybe not, but will, you know, sort of push people to be involved and to think about the
mm-hmm.
issues.
I see. That's convincing, I think. Semper Fidelis is a telling pseudonym to choose. There's no question about that. Now, Anne Trask, where did that come from?
I wish I knew.
I looked that up in the phone book.
And it's quite funny because I certainly, you know, have some grounds to speculate that Jenny may be short for Joan,
uh-huh.
Which is, you know, Joe Ann Trask or Joan Trask,
uh-huh.
sometimes also appears, or Ann J. Trask. And she also, when she is writing as Mrs. Trask, she writes about Mr. Trask, and she gives Mr. Trask the first name Darby, which of course shares the first letter with her husband Dennis
yeah.
Carter, and it's
uh-huh.
very, very clear in her writing that Mr. Trask is Dennis Carter, because she jokes about his musical instruments being left everywhere around the house.
Uh-huh.
Dennis Carter, of course, is a music teacher.
Uh-huh.
So it's clear that she sort of picked that D word to, you know, to as you know, a sort of inside joke.
Yeah.
Where the Trask comes from, I don't have the faintest idea yet.
Okay.
And how that name came about, I don't know yet.
Okay. What do you think that Jenny Carter's place will be in 19th century letters or 19th century African American letters?
Should it be? I guess I would say first that I hope it goes more broadly than that, because there are certainly a number of rich comparisons that we could make to African-American writers of the period. I think a logical connection, and somebody wonderful to read next to her, are the work of Frances Helen Watkins Harper, who writes a group of serialized novels for the Christian Recorder, eventually publishes a novel in book form later, writes poems, crisscrosses the country doing lectures on temperance and talks about questions of suffrage. So, you know, somebody, you know, comparing her with somebody like Harper or somebody like Douglas in his older years, because of course Douglas is still, you know, engaged in a national scheme at this time. I think that she in some ways speaks in rich ways to thinking about those folks as participants in a much larger literate culture.
Uh-huh.
But beyond that, the fact that she chooses the short form and that she does so much with the short form makes me think that you know, we ought to also be setting her next to people like Mark Twain or
uh-huh.
Bret Hart,
mm-hmm.
who are also writing out of this short sketch tradition,
mm-hmm.
Very much grounded in the West, and for both of them very specifically in California,
mm-hmm.
Or somebody like Fanny Fern,
mm-hmm.
the noted columnist in the East, Sarah Parton Willis, So I think putting her in dialogue with this idea of what to do with the short form, what to do with the press essay, or, you know, the piece that appears in the newspaper or the magazine, in broader American letters
mm-hmm.
would be equally valuable. And that's something that we haven't talked a lot about. Literary study oftentimes tends to focus on the bound book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of weird corollary to the Academy's obsession with the monograph.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be bound and covered.
Right.
And a lot of black writing was not that way. A lot of women's writing, white and black, was not that way, at least first. And a lot of white men's writing of the period wasn't that way either.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting a broader sense of all of this, you know, this textual culture that we, you know, finally get to see on a national level with, you know, everything changing from the structure of the printing press to distribution networks, you know, putting her there and saying, oh, well, I wonder, you know, if we set her next to Mark Twain, I wonder what happens.
Interesting. Yeah.
So, you know, so hopefully that too. And also, I think, you know, beyond those pieces, of placing her in the moment and in dialogue with folks, I hope first and foremost that folks just see her as the lively voice that she is.
Yeah.
I'm still stunned by probably my favorite of the columns is she writes a column about in childhood Dennis Drummond Carter was separated from one of his cousins Henry Drummond.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry Drummond is an orphan at that point. His parents have died, and so he is bound out. And in essence, if you're a free African American child and you're bound out and you don't have a fine family that's well positioned to fight for you, so he's a slave.
Mm-hmm.
She writes this very, very touching column about the love between Dennis and his cousin Henry.
Uh-huh.
And ends it with the plea that, you know, if Henry Drummond is out there and reads this, or if you know Henry Drummond, please write us, because I know that you know, my husband would shed those same tears that he shed as a boy when they were separated.
Wow.
And that's in so many ways, you know, if you look at black newspapers after the Civil War, all the way up until the 1890s, across the board, you'll see these information wanted ads that, you know, say seeking information on Jane, who was owned by Henry Smith of Accomack County, Virginia. Please send information to, because, you know, think about it. If you're, you know, if you've just been freed, the first thing you're going to do is try and find your family if you've been separated.
Yeah.
And all of those little information wanted paragraphs that are, you know, one or two lines long, I think don't get read and don't get recognized for the, you know, the kind of emotional power that they pack.
Exactly.
And Carter says, okay, I'm gonna do an information one of that, but I'm gonna tell you the whole story.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna do it in a narrative form, and I'm gonna let you know a little bit about the people that are involved in this. And to be able to take that, you know, that kind of event that lots of folks have ignored, and to tell the story around it, and through telling that story, get folks to understand and get folks to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that she's doing, and so that's the, you know, that's what I want folks to, you know, folks to recognize.
That is remarkable. That is such an interesting point you just made about these advertisements for people's lost relatives. That really is, it's again, it's one of these things that I kind of knew about, but I had just forgotten. Yeah, I know that it was the case that in the Soviet Union and also in Germany after the war, because so many people were lost, that people would put placards everywhere and would stand at train stations and put one hands in papers and so on and so forth looking for their lost relatives who've been lost during the war. But it is a very poignant thing, and it is an extraordinarily good idea for a literary essay. And we should thank Jenny Carter for writing it. And we should thank you, because we've taken up so much of your morning. I bet those twins want you. So
they're doing pretty cool. It's always safe. That's the only reason why we've had a fully quiet hour.
Exactly.
But thank you too. It's been wonderful.
Yeah. So why don't you close just by telling us what you're working on right now?
Lots of different things. I want to do, of course, more work on Jenny Carter, because there's that 30 years that is empty so far, and there's got to be something else out there. But I'm also doing some broader work on the black press, some more work on the elevator, trying to track some other folks down, and also working with a variety of other black periodicals that, again, have been largely ignored.
Mm-hmm.
A piece that just came out that talks about some work from a periodical that was published out of Indianapolis, Indiana, mm-hmm. in the late 1850s, called The Repository of Religion of Literature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who thinks about the fact that there's this quarterly black magazine being published out of Indianapolis's black community, yeah. before the Civil War? And the pieces that the piece that just came out is a couple of works by early black activist Mariah Stewart, who, uh-huh. everybody thought wasn't writing at all in the 50s and 60s. And it turns out, well, she sent this material to this black magazine in Indianapolis, of all places. Hmm. And so, you know, trying to sketch out what the broader landscape of African American letters looks like, tracing literary communities, mm-hmm. in all of these different unexpected places. Mm-hmm. Digging in the archive and trying to bring up some good stuff to share with folks.
Well, it sounds like you got a full plate with the twins.
Always fun.
With these
Always
projects
fun.
And everything else.
It wouldn't happen any other way.
Well, Eric, thank you very, very much for writing this book and for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Gardner, the author of Jenny Carter, a Black Journalist of the Early West. I'm Marshall Poe. I'm the host of New Books in History, and we hope to see you next week. Bye-bye. Thank you.